ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another live edition of The Gold Reality right here on the Oracle Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank everybody for being here today for this Tuesday edition of the broadcast, Tuesday, January 6th, 2009. We will be live with you for the next 4 hours with a ton of news and information, as usual, here to get into on the broadcast today. We do have a lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of important news, a lot of very important stories to get into today. And we're glad you all could be with us today. We're going to be getting into the important news and information of the day. Several stories from yesterday I want to get into, I didn't get into as well as the stuff that came out today. Also, I want to get into probably coming up in the third hour of the broadcast again today. We will continue in our reading out of the book, The World Order, written by Eustace Mullins. We started that yesterday in chapter one with the Rothschilds. Very important information in there, especially considering in this day and age. It's important to go back over this information and really detailing, well, exactly who are the Rothschilds. You know, you hear those, you hear their names thrown around in circles of the alternative research community. You hear these thrown around, but does anybody even really know the history, where it came from, and really who the players are and breaking it down? So I think that's important. That's why we'll continue to read out of that. Obviously, there's plenty of news on the Gaza and Israeli thing, plenty of that. We'll cover the important story as far as that's concerned here in just a bit. And don't forget, coming up on the program tomorrow, right at the beginning of the show, right at this time tomorrow, probably with us for a few hours, I'm sure. But tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, join us on the broadcast. Michael Cesarian with us tomorrow on the show. It's always great when Michael comes on the broadcast with us, and I know tomorrow will be no exception. I'm starting out with this story because I just, you know, there's other stories I guess I could get into that's more important, but this one to me, it just, folks, this is what I've been trying to tell you. What did we talk about yesterday? And I know that there's people in the chat room. I know Donna in the chat room will know exactly what I'm talking about here with this article. But what did I talk about yesterday? What did we say? We talked about the FBI infiltrating these peaceful protest groups and trying to pin people down as terrorists that are doing nothing more than exercising their First Amendment right. Well, you're not going to believe this. Well, maybe you will. And I'll put this one in the chat room for you. This is from, lo and behold, unbelievably, this is from Democracy Now. Prominent Austin activist admits he infiltrated RNC protest groups as FBI informant. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you know, and you guys know as well as I do, I live in Dallas, Texas, but in Austin, the huge scene for the Patriot Movement, Truth Movement, that whole thing. And, I've been trying to tell people, look, there's spooks running around everywhere. They're running around everywhere. They're running. I mean, you know, this is why I quit being in the 9/11 groups and the meetup groups, because it got to the point where you could tell there's infiltration going on. An Austin-based activist named Brandon Darby has revealed he worked as an FBI informant in the 18 months leading up to the Republican National Convention. Darby has admitted to wearing recording devices and planning meetings, and wearing a transmitter embedded in his belt during the convention. He's expected to testify on behalf of the government later this month in the trial of two Texas activists who were arrested at the RNC on charges of making and possessing Molotov cocktails. We turn now to a story out of Austin, Texas that has shocked social justice activists nationwide. A prominent Austin-based activist named Brandon Darby has revealed he worked as an FBI informant in the 18 months lead up to the Republican National Convention. In a statement, a group of Austin-based activists called the Austin Informant Working Group condemned Darby. The group says, "The emerging truth about Darby's malicious involvement in our communities is heartbreaking, early ground shattering for those of us who were closest to it." The statement goes on to raise suspicions that Darby may have gone beyond spying on the accused activists, but in fact encouraged and provoked them into breaking the law. Well, I mean, first off, bottom line of it is that if you're engaging in breaking the law in any sort of protest activity, you know, you're gonna have to deal with consequences. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, it sucks that the feds are running around putting infiltrators down, but goddamn, you got to be careful out there, folks. You know, I mean, this stuff doesn't require you to go out and break the law, okay? That's the bottom line. So, if you're in one of these groups and you get somebody trying to get you to do something that's illegal, you need to walk the other way. I mean, it's hard for me to have pity sometimes on these people, you know, and to be honest with you, this whole thing stinks to high heaven to me anyway. The whole thing, I think they're all in together. This Darby character who infiltrated, and the guy who, the two people that were charged with possessing Molotov cocktails. I mean, it's a total provocateur situation. You know, I mean, I'm sorry. The thing about this stuff does not require you to break the law to be involved in. Yeah, I see people talking in the chat room. Yeah, I mean, if you're in the Fed rally and somebody's trying to get you to go spray paint a bank, those are Fed. Yeah, good call there, brother. In the chat room, Space Boy Rocks. Yeah, good call there. Yeah, you know, that's obviously that was provocateur. Obviously, if you're in the Fed rally and somebody wants to get you to throw rocks at a building or you know spray paint F the Federal Reserve on the side of a building, yeah, that's walk away from that. Tell them you're not interested. Tell them that's not how you roll. You know, you don't roll like that. You don't. That's not what you choose to do. And just walk away. Get out of it. I've said it once, and I've said it a thousand times. I am 100% nonviolent in anything that I do to get out information. And I will always be that way. But that's what these people want, and that's why they infiltrate these groups and try to get you to make Molotov cocktails and go spray paint buildings and all this stuff, because they need us to be portrayed as crazy. That's the problem I have with some of these, radio hosts and some of these other people out there that do all this insane, crazy activity because, it's guilt by association. Get us roped in with those people that you know that are just maniacs when we just want to get out information. More news, more topics, lots to talk about on the other side. This is the Tuesday edition of the Global Reality. Stay with us.
America. What if the change was not the change I expected? What if the only remedy for sickness and disease was to take drugs? Prepare and defend your body. In an ever-changing world, infiltrate every level of your system every day. Take charge. Order now. Don't wait until it's too late.
Of the 3 million plus edible food, no other single plant or the powder, seeds, and oil of the hemp plant. We want to educate our listeners for free. Not the protein that contains gluten impairs the cells from absorbing nutrients. And this nutrient-dense food can be stored vacuum-packed and is priced affordably. Allow this food to work for you. The body will react and heal itself given the proper nutrition. This will be your greatest asset. So try it today, store it today, and change your life. Call or order from hempua.org. Hemp is superfood and THC is marijuana and is certified not.
We Rogers here. The global controllers are continuing their quest. The one thing standing in their way are free thinkers. In these troubled times, it is imperative that we the people are not destroyed for a lack of knowledge, but are instead empowered with alternative news and information on the internet. Whether it's geopolitics, globalism, government corruption, the unraveling global economy, staged elections, false flag terrorism, the technological control grid, martial law, the police state, or our issues of real significance, you'll find raw, fully sourced information. Be sure to empower yourself with the news and information the corporate controlled mockingbirds don't want you to know about.
You are now the home of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.
Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today, folks. Strangers on this road, we are not two, we are one. And I tell you what, you know, what's going on over there in the Middle East, you know, and I'm, you know, again, I mentioned we're going to have Michael Bazzarian on with us tomorrow. And one of the things that he talks about, and I'll definitely be getting his take on this whole thing, is, you know, you're definitely going to see, I guarantee you folks, you're going to see something here real soon in the United States. You're going to see a school shooting. And, you know, that's one of the things that Vasari mentions in his new film is, you know, people see something like, 50 or 33 dead at Virginia Tech, and it's a tragedy. And, it's horrible, but yet, you know, they pay no attention to the hundreds and thousands that are being killed overseas. And that is because they're programmed to do so. I mean, look at how much apathy is going around right now with your average everyday citizen about what's going on in Gaza. You know, hey, I mean, people just don't care. I mean, I remember last Friday I was saying on the show, look, they're gonna launch this ground invasion on Saturday. I knew they were gonna do it. All the indicators were there, and of course they did. And what did they do? They launched it right in the middle of the NFL playoffs. I mean, right in the middle. I mean, right when the kickoff, literally, folks, right when the kickoff started for the game, for the first game, is when they kicked off the ground invasion. You know, it is by design. It's all created and concocted. And it's all done in a very precise manner. None of it is any sort of coincidence. So let's get into this one from the AFP. Israel escalates offensive into Gaza cities. Israeli tanks and helicopter gunships went blazing into towns across the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, attacking Hamas targets and searching for its leaders as the war death toll approached 600. And, you know, I saw some people in the chat room making comments yesterday saying, look, you know, 500, 600, come on. Those aren't real numbers, and I agree wholeheartedly with that. My estimation from what I've looked at, from what I've looked at other overseas articles, we're looking at 2,000 to 3,000 dead at this point, not 600. Now, that's an estimation. I have no way of verifying that 100%. Just let me put that out there, but I'm just going by what I've looked at, the stories I've looked at coming out of, from over there. We're looking at 2,000 to 3,000 dead right now, not 600. I mean, have you seen the devastation? Give me a break. And I still think 2,000 to 3,000 is probably being conservative. If I had to guess, if I had to make an educated guess, I'd say it's probably closer to 5,000. But from what I've looked at, so 600, I mean, come on. I mean, they're still telling us what, that only like a couple of 100,000 been killed in the war in Iraq? We know that number's well over 2 million. Give me a break. Truth fighters on its militants around the back alleys of Gaza's main city. And the heaviest fighting of the 11-day-old offensive, the Hulk rocket attacks on Israel, Hamas made its deepest rocket strike yet into Israel. And who's firing these rockets? Who funded alleged Hamas to fire these rockets? Mossad, MI6, the CIA. You know, this isn't just random militants firing this, folks. If you can't find an enemy, you're going to make an enemy. And that's what they do. That's what they do every time. And they, you know, this is no different from that. Same old, same old. Europe must open its eyes, President Shimon Peres told an EU ministerial delegation that demand a truce. We are not in the business of public relations or improving our image. We are fighting against terror, and we have every right to defend our citizens. Black smoke covered districts of the Gaza City and the edges of Deir al-Bala, and now Berej, where heavy fighting raged on Tuesday. No, I didn't drop. I turned my mic down for a second so I could sneeze. One airstrike killed 12 people, including 7 children. From the same family in Gaza City, Israeli strikes also hit 2 UN-run schools, one crowded with refugees, killing at least 5 Palestinians, mentioned the UN officials said. 2 people were killed when artillery shells slammed into a school in Khan Yunis, and 3 people were killed in an airstrike on school in the Nishadi refugee camp in Gaza City. They said 4 Israeli soldiers were killed in 2 friendly fire incidents during the overnight surge in fighting. The army said 5 have now died since Saturday. About 12 Hamas rockets were fired over the border, one reaching 45 kilometers. Or 28 miles inside the Israeli border, the deepest yet, lightly wounding a baby in Israel. That's the most we've seen. Yeah, of course it's genocide. Of course that's what it is. The whole plan, the whole New World Order plan is genocide. It's mass genocide. It's mass blood sacrifice. It's on and on. That's what it is. And that's what you're going to continue to see. You know, this is what's going on here. And meanwhile, you know, you're sitting at home watching it on TV going, that's a shame. Glad that's not happening here. Yeah, I bet you are. More on the other side. Tuesday edition of the Global Reality, folks. I'm your host, Josh Reese. Stay with us.
Host providers on the net. The TeamSpeak server acts as a host to multiple client connections capable of handling literally thousands of simultaneously. With TeamSpeak, you can easily stay connected with your fellow group members or start a special group to invite others to join. Whether you seek a private communication medium or would prefer to host...
They say that you could travel the world without leaving your home through the pages of a book. All the adventures that you could imagine when you travel through the pages of their books. But have stores located around the world and have been in business for over 2 decades.
You are now listening to Oracle Broadcast, the home of cutting edge.
With the only global reality. Wow, that was, the music faded down quicker than the timer led on to be there. So we're back here on the global reality right here on the Oracle Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today. Any others? This article, another article here. Norwegian doctor, this is from yesterday, actually. Norwegian doctor says Israel intentionally targeting civilians. Doctor estimates 2,500 civilian casualties dead. So, yeah, my estimation there was correct. So, yeah, we're probably looking, I mean, this doctor saying 2,500 civilian casualties alone. Total casualties probably running close to 5,000, you know, at this point. I don't think that's far-fetched. Unbelievable. But really not, they're really not unbelievable at the same time. I mean, you know, this hopefully this is going to be a wake-up call for people to understand what it is we're up against. You know, when you have a Zionist regime taking over the United States of America, and it's not like this is new. I mean, we have one leaving. But, you know, I think that these things are like, you know, the who's really in control, who's really pulling the strings. You know, I've actually heard people in our own ranks say, oh, you don't need to worry about who's in control, who's pulling the strings. Well, yeah, you do. And I'm sorry, I've bit my tongue on this for a long time, and I haven't ever said anything, but yeah, you do need to worry about who's in charge, and yeah, you do need to worry about pulling the strings, because if you don't, you're going to be led down some path where somebody's going to tell you who it is they think is pulling the strings, or who it is that's in charge. And if we don't wake people up and let people know who is pulling the strings and who is in charge, then how in the hell is anybody going to know who to go after to stop this crap? So, you know, I'm sorry, and I know that that's a disagreement with some people. you know, some radio hosts out there and some, you know, some people that, you know, and whatnot. But you know what? I'm sorry. It is important. You know, you can sit around all day long and talk about pipe dream solutions, about getting people involved at the local level and all this crap. But you know, what good is it going to be if you're trying to operate within a system that's controlled anyway? And it requires you to be corrupted to have any sort of success in it. Maude Gilder, a Norwegian doctor working in Gaza, told Sky News on Monday that he believes Israel is deliberately attacking the Palestinian population, not just targeting Hamas, as Israel authorities have said numerous times. Well, what do you think? Again, this is about genocide. This is about death. The more death, the better it is. Just a little bit more than an hour ago, the Israelis bombed a central food market in Gaza City. And we had a mass influx of about 50 injured and between 10 and 15 killed, said Gilder on the phone with Sky News. At the same time, they bombed an apartment house with children playing on the roof. And we had a lot of children also. This is really like from Dante's Inferno. It's like hell here now, and it's been bombing all night up till now. Close to 500 people have been killed, and the number of casualties is getting to 2,500, which 50% of are children and women. This is a doctor saying 50% are women and children. 50%. And there's just been so many people that have sat around and for years and sort of been apathetic to this information. And I'm tired of the apathy. You know what the number one killer in this country is right now? It's not cancer, it's not heart disease, it's not drinking and driving, it's not drug abuse. The number one killer in this country right now, in this day and age, is apathy. And I see so much of that with people that I know, and it drives me absolutely, you know what, crazy. Because I know people, I have family members like it. I mean, I know people all the time, I mean, they believe everything I tell them. They believe everything that comes out of my mouth. But you know what? They just don't care. They're not affected by it. They're just apathetic to it. And that is the number one killer in this country right now, as far as I'm concerned. That's what is killing us quicker than anything is apathy. It's people who just don't care. They know what's going on, but it's just they're oblivious to it. They just choose not to even know. Well, yeah, I believe everything you're saying, and yeah, I don't doubt that any of it's that it's true. But I'm just going to go on with my life and not worry about it. But yet, you think that by having this apathy and not caring, and just you know, walking around unaffected. So that still entitles you to live in some sort of country where, you know, you're going to be able to raise your kids just fine. You're going to be able to live your life just fine. Well, let me tell you something. I'm here to tell you right now that that's not going to happen. You turn the lights off on this stuff, and you're going to turn the lights out on the rest of your life. And you need to listen to me good, loud, and clear right now. But I know that a lot of people won't. Doesn't matter. Why? Because it takes this stuff coming home and biting them on the ass before they ever wake up to it. And that's just a harsh reality. I'm sorry. Oh, Josh, I wish I would have listened to you when you told me not to vote for Obama. Well, it's too late now, isn't it? Oh, I wish I would have listened to you when, you told me this, that, or the other. I mean, I get that all the time. Well, you know, it's time for you to stop after the fact saying you wish you would have listened to me and buck up and step to the plate and start listening to me when I'm trying to tell you this stuff. We don't have time for apathy anymore. We don't have time for people to go, I voted for Obama. That was a mistake. We don't have time for people to go, I got my kids vaccinated and now they got autism. That was a mistake. We just don't have time for that. I'm not trying to be mean or condescending, but the point of the matter is that when are you going to wake up and when are we all going to stop? You know, and we're all guilty of it. I'm not sitting here saying that I'm not, guilty of just letting them engage in their apathy. Yeah, sure I am. Because, you know, you get to that point where, you know, you're just like, well, what good is it going to do? You know, you can, there's some people out there that you could slap inside the hip. They just don't want to see the truth. Because, again, as we talked about many times here, the acceptance of this stuff does make you have to take on some sort of personal responsibility for it. And I think that's it more than anything why people engage in apathy is because they don't want to have the responsibility of having to do something about it. You know, they see you doing the things you do. They see the sacrifices you make. They see the way you have to live your life to be involved in this stuff and attempting to wake this stuff up, and they see that, you know, there's no money in it, and they see there's no glory in it, and there's no fame in it, and you know, and it's not that easy, and you're looked down upon as a whole by society, and so they don't want to engage in that kind of thing. They don't want to be a part of it. Well, I'm here to tell you right now, in my entire life I've never given a rat's ass what anybody ever thought about me, and I still don't, and I never will. And that's what makes me an effective fighter. Because I don't care what you think about me. What I care is what you think about this information and what you're going to do with it. You know, people always try to say something, you know, you're a hothead or you have a temper. They say, look, I'm the lowest common denominator here, folks. I'm the least important link in this chain. And if you're trying to drag my personality into the whether or not you accept the info, whether or not you want to choose to wake up, get to the next level, and bring other people to that level. You know, you've got serious issues, and you really need to get your priorities straight. More on the other side. This is The Global Reality. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Stay with us.
CelebrityStickers.com will allow you to express your rights and allow millions of people to see you stand up for what you believe. Stickers online ranging from political to humorous, and as you don't see what you're looking for, Liberty Stickers, the pre-made stickers that will get everyone talking. That's Liberty Stickers.
Howdy, 2012.
We have a new president coming into office in January. He's for sickness and disease was to take drugs. This hasn't happened yet. I repeat, not yet. Prepare and defend your body with GIPA-T28-308-0408. Order now, 928.
History will always remember. Long live those strong stories. You're listening to
the Revolution. Don't you think it's fair? What happened to the world?
Global Reality on this Tuesday edition of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today for the broadcast. Lots of news, lots of information to get into today on the duration of the show. But nonetheless, you know, that's the biggest killer. That's the biggest thing is the apathy. And, you know, I don't know. You know, it's what's worse? What's worse? Are the people who don't know about this information, the people who blindly follow what the television tells them, and blindly follow groupthink, and, you know, I mean, most of these people don't even know any better. You know, we always talk about we got to wake up the sheeple and all this stuff. You know, is it those people that we need to wake up? I mean, yes, that's important, and yes, it's important we need to wake people up their slumber, but what's worse? Mindlessly following something that you don't even know exists, or knowing that this stuff exists, but choosing just to ignore it. What's worse? I believe that the latter. I believe that knowing that this stuff exists and just choosing to, you know, be apathetic about it and just say, oh, well, you know, yeah, I know about it. Yeah, I believe everything you're saying. Yeah, I know it's true, but, you know, I just ignore it. I mean, that's, you know, that's a – well, let's get back into this. Here's one for you. This one. There's another one to make my blood boil right here. This comes to us from the Navy Times today. And this is probably one, considering all this is going to go on, it's going to get lost in the memory hole, but I think this is a very important story. No Purple Hearts for PTSD, Pentagon rules. The Purple Heart will not be awarded to service members suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, the Pentagon confirmed on Monday. It's not a qualifying Purple Heart wound, said Defense Department spokesman Aline Lanes, although she added that advances in medical science may support future reevaluation. So what they do is, and of course the Purple Heart is awarded to anyone who's wounded in battle. Well, if you're wounded in battle or once you are released from active duty, they send you into a mandatory psychological screening. And in that mandatory psychological screening, it's their job to make sure that you are determined to have PTSD or one of these other mental ailments so that they can issue you a psychotropic substance like Paxil or Zoloft or something like that. That's their job. You know why that's their job? Because, what was it, last year, I think the story came out where they now ruled that any active duty servicemen who comes back and is deemed to have one of these psychological disorders and is put on one of these psychotropic drugs now can't own a gun. So now they've determined that if they show that you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you're not going to get a Purple Heart. This is the world we're in now. And they're moving away from this. I mean, you know, these battlefield augmentations they're moving into that DARPA's been working on, they're a reality, where they put microchips and implants inside the bodies of the soldiers, where they can remote control, juice them with all sorts of drugs, stimulants, this, you know, government-issued methamphetamines they issue the troops to keep them up and awake and aware during, you know, in long battles. Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah. They have government-issued methamphetamine they issue troops. It's a reality. I've known people that have been in service. They've told me about it. It's government-issued methamphetamine. They have it. They issue it to soldiers, folks. You know, why do you think these guys come back and they're, you know, they're drugged out, brain dead, just, you know, people think, well, they're going to become cops. And next thing you know, they shoot a civilian or something. That's because this is what they want. They want you one of two. They want you one of three ways. Here's the thing. They want you dead. They want you to come back and be a Homeland Security civilian-killing goon, or they want you a brain-dead piece of mush. That's the only way they want you. That's the only way you're good to them. Second hour around the corner. Stay with us.
Troubled times, it is imperative that we the people are not destroyed for our lack of knowledge, but are instead empowered with information. RogueGovernment.com and BlacklistNews.com are two of the best sources of alternative news and information on the internet.
As America limps on the Slash Leg Network.
Second hour of this Tuesday edition of The Global Reality. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today for the show. I want to read this story for you now, and this is from theheraldmail.com. And we're seeing more and more of this talk. And, again, this is part and parcel of them trying to own the information. And it's called We Should Be Worried About 2012. We'll talk about this in just a second. Theheraldmail.com article here, We Should Be Worried About 2012. You see this programming going on where they're attempting to own the information. And they're now using it to fear-monger people. And I think they're also using it to push people more towards their religion. If you're nervous about our prospects going into 2009, don't be. We still have 3 years left. Let me put this in the chat room for you guys as well. It's in 2012 that all the terror is going to break loose. According to some cryptic drawings by legendary seer Nostradamus, they were interpreted liberally Sunday night on the History Channel. Nostradamus was a French apothecary who lived in the 1500s and wrote Les Prophéties, a series of mysterious verses that are said to have foreseen many modern events. Near as I can tell, Nostradamus is tonic for people who would normally be predisposed to UFO chasing but do not like to go outside. His overriding message was that bad things will happen in the future, and since bad things have indeed come to pass, well, that makes his reputation pretty much airtight. Of course, the great prophets never see anything good coming. Do they know prophet ever predicted the Civil Rights Act, automatic transmissions, or Camp David? Of course, this is such fluff. The bottom line of it is that Nostradamus was trained in the Kabbalah. If you haven't seen Chris Everard's new film, Spirit World 2, The Alien Kabbalah, you need to get a copy of that film. You know, and, you know, the bottom line of it is that Nostradamus was trained in Kabbalism. He was trained in the occult. He was trained in dark magic. He was trained as a seer. He was trained to go into the future. I mean, think about about his predictions with, and I'm not putting my stock in Nostradamus by any means. What I'm saying is, look at the bottom line of it is what you can prove is that this guy was going into the spirit realms, you know, this guy was like huffing nutmeg and all this crazy stuff and doing all this weird, going into these trances. He was pulling stuff back out and pulling information out of the spirit world. So essentially what this article is trying to do is it's trying to further minimize the fact that you have people at the highest levels of government you always have. Nostradamus was, he was called in by queens, kings. He was called in by the highest people. I mean, he predicted that the Queen of Scotland would have five of her sons all become kings and then die before she did. With 100% accuracy, he predicted that. And other things. But the point of the matter is, the real underlying thing of this story is the fact that what they're trying to do here is to minimize people waking up to the fact that there are people that engage in this communication in other realms. And people are waking up to it. You know, with films coming out, people are starting to have more of an interest in it. But that's because there is no money in it. We only want to hear the bad stuff. Well, that's exactly right. I mean, he's got that right there. There's no money in the truth. So why will 2012 be so bad? Because it marks a cosmic alignment where the sun appears to rise in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, which is an event that occurs only once every 13,000 years. Last time it happened marked the beginning of an ice age, or the end of an ice age. I forget. See how he says that? Oh, I don't remember which one it is. One or the other. Well, that's absolutely provable. But yet, you notice how he says, well, I don't know. I don't remember which one it was. This is the kind of stuff they put out that further keeps the sheep mentality in the state it's in now. That's what the point of this article is. This is to neutralize critical thinking on all aspects. And I don't, you know, I've never claimed to ever get up here, and I've never claimed to have some definitive thing on 2012. I just don't know. I don't think it's going to be the end of the world, but, you know, there's definitely the end of the world as we know it, as it appears to us, and we don't think we have any context for what that will be. That's where the real questions come in. Nostradamus is coming because in one of his drawings is a symbol vaguely resembling the letter S, and when viewed from a certain angle, the Milky Way vaguely resembles the letter S. Well, yeah, it looks like a serpent. There's pictures of that you can read. You can see. That's evidence enough for me, but I realize there are going to be skeptics out there who demand more proof, pointing out this particular symbol resembles a plankton as much as a galaxy, and even if it is a stylized galaxy, there is nothing to tie it into the year 2012. There are further likely to point out that none of the experts hauled in front of the camera to explain those Thomas prophecies look normal. What's that mean? What does that have to do with anything? They're usually aging guys with gray ponytails who begin each sentence with the word clearly, even when there is nothing clear about what they're trying to explain. Clearly, that is a symbol for the Milky Way, or clearly what Nostradamus meant was this. Fair enough, but if you're still dubious, get this. The Egyptian pyramids are aligned with the stars. Somehow, and on top of that, the Mayan calendar runs out in 2012, December 21st, to be exact, around 4:35 p.m. If that's not enough to make you cancel the long-term disability coverage on your insurance plan, I don't know what is. I mean, you see what I mean? Give them a little bit of truth, whet the appetite a little bit, and then bring them back down to that low-level sheep mentality. This is good propaganda, very good propaganda. That's why I'm reading. You know, I mean, good propaganda gives you a little bit of truth and then slams you back down to that lower-level mentality where you're back thinking about your insurance plan or something. I could not be more convinced that the entire CNBC stock market predicting crew were to forecast Earth's demise. There is a caveat, however, but it's not what you might expect. Usually when you hear apocalyptic predictions, it comes with a caveat. For example, it's most likely he meant the world will end in 2012, but it could be some years later. It's a standard hedge against being wrong, which to date, the end days predictions have always been. But this year, the doomsayers are speeding things up. It might be 2012, but it might be sooner. The world might be starting to unravel now. Uh-oh, that's not good. The end is near crowd is falling over itself, so move the date up, not back. That's how you know things must really be in a bad way. Well, no matter. They can always misinterpret Nostradamus again to make the prediction fit the current circumstance. And here's, you know what I'm going to do? This ass clown that wrote this article, he's going to love me for this. His name's Tim Rowland, and he writes for the Herald, and you can email him at tim.com, and you can also call him at area code 301-301-31, extension 2324, and you can call Tim Rowland and tell him what an ass hat he is. So there you go. I love when these people write these dumbass articles and then they're stupid enough to put their email address and their number down there. Because I've done this before and we will firebomb this guy. Yeah, exactly. Good propaganda. Well, what am I going to do about the drapes? Oh, man. I mean, this is exactly the kind of stuff where, you know, now we've got the 2012 movie coming out this summer. And John Cusack's going to save the world from impending doom in 2012. Well, that alone, to me, tells you the world's coming to an end. If John Cusack's going to save us from 2012, we're screwed already. I mean, let's just go ahead and pack it up. What's he going to do, put on a Clash t-shirt and grab a boombox and hold it up at the big flood or something? I mean, goodness. But, of course, you know, it's all a part of the propaganda. It's all a part of fictionalizing the truth so the truth seems like fiction. So when you try to talk to somebody about 2012...
there you go. You watch that John Cusack movie, didn't you? Barbara Dean Day.
More on the other side, Tuesday edition of the Global Reality. Stay with us.
My face. Many people do not realize how effective a tool it can be.
Hi folks, Doug Owen here for TexasTeamSpeak.com. We're to invite others to join. Whether you seek a private communication medium or would prefer to host, use TexasTeamSpeak.com.
They say that you could travel the world without leaving your home through the pages of a book. Books. Adventures Unlimited carries an eclectic diversity of subjects such as alternative health and science, adventure, free energy, ancient history, Native American studies, and much, much more. Get away from the daily grind, unwind, and feed your mind to free your mind. Information is on there as you like.
And preserving the rights of the people. We're tired of losing our rights. And allow millions of people to see you stand up for what you believe in. Source for Ron Paul for President stickers. As always, you can find your favorite stickers.
Thomas Jefferson said, Dr. Mary's Monkey is a book of profound importance. It helps us understand what has really happened in our country. Daniel Estulin's award-winning international bestseller, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, was hailed by editors at a major New York publisher, but then stopped by higher-ups. After you read this book, Exposing the Secret Plans of the World's Elite, you'll understand why.
Cutting Edge Talk Radio.
Follow the revolution.
Thank you.
Back here with you, Look Over Reality, on this Tuesday edition of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you for being with us today. And we got a lot more to talk about and get into. You know, I know a lot of you have seen this by now. It's been played out. That's why I didn't play it yesterday. And because I knew it was going to be played out everywhere, and you've already heard it many times. But if you haven't heard the clip of Henry Kissinger on CNBC yesterday for the 5 millionth time, calling for saying Obama's going to lead them to the New World Order, you should go listen to that clip. I'm not going to play it. It's been played out. But still, I mean, when I was making my film, 9/11 New World Rising, I got enough of hearing him say New World Order when I was making that film. I'm going to say that like six times in that movie, so unbelievable stuff. But, you know, I mean, they're ramping up there. They're ramping up everything. This should come as no surprise to you either. This is from Reuters today. FBI plans large hiring blitz of agents and experts. Wanted by the FBI, agents, language specialists, computer experts, intelligence analysts, and finance experts. The FBI said on Monday it launched one of the largest hiring blitzes in its 100-year history, involving 2,100 professional staff vacancies and 850 special agents aimed at filling its most critical vacancies. And we had the story last year where we covered, it was an ABC News article here, where the Homeland Security offices have nothing but empty desks in them. You know why? Because they can't get anybody to do these stupid Reichland security jobs. That's why. But everything's moving to that. That's the new job economy. Listen, how many of you out there heard those commercials on the radio? I know you have. You've been driving around your car at any point with mainstream radio on, music radio, you've heard the commercials. Homeland Security, come here. Go to such and such college to learn. Department of Homeland Security, learn how to sit behind a desk and watch CCTV cameras 24 hours a day. Learn how to become a TSA goon. Learn how to become a defender of the killer of the First Amendment. I mean, defender of the First Amendment. So, I mean, that's what the job market's moving towards now. And, you know, the FBI is having a hiring blitz because they can't get anybody to do these jobs anymore. So once they get in there and they realize it's not about protecting America, it's not about protecting people and keeping people safe, it's about you're hired to kill America, and that's all there is to it. The agency would seek to protect the United States from terrorist attacks, fight crime, and catch spies, among other duties, said it currently has more than 12,800 agents and about 18,400 other employees. Since the September 11, 2001 attacks, the FBI has been criticized for not having enough employees fluent in foreign language, for not moving fast enough to upgrade its computer system. Yeah, it's always sending, oh, poor us. See, again, we're back to that same old thing, the right pretext, you see. This is how it always is. Well, we've got these old computer systems, and we can't get people in here, so we have to have, that's exactly what 9/11 was. I mean, you remember this character, Sean Cranish, that was involved in that whole thing? He goes to jail for having a pistol holster without a pistol on it, and lo and behold, here comes Larry Pratt to the rescue. Here comes Larry Pratt coming to pay for his bail. Then he gets put in jail for using a Liberty Dollar. 2 weeks later, Liberty Dollar goes down. Then about a month after that, he's involved in bringing this Dutch character into Edna Lane Brown's, and then they go down. I mean, come on, folks. Give me a freaking break. We're on the other side. Go over reality. Stick with us.
Hi, folks.
Edition of the Global Reality right here on Oracle Broadcasting. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I thank you for being with us today for the show. I thank you for always being with us. I want to thank all our AM and FM affiliates out there, 100.1 FM Austin, Texas, all the other big AM and FM stations out there carrying the show as well as RadioActiveTalk.com, RevereRadio.net, FU Radio, Freedom Underground Radio. They don't carry the show, but thank you to those guys anyway for being there. Thank you to all the networks, all the members of the Rebel Alliance. Oh, I'm way out of line, huh? Oh, you know that for sure, huh? Okay. All right. Well, you go on and just keep on thinking that then. And yeah. I'll field that question to Donna Van Meter in the chat room. Donna, take care of that for me. I don't have time for this. I'm way out of line, huh? Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? I'm not even going to go there. You know, I will go there, actually. This guy's involved in Larry Craig. How can you? I mixed up the sequence of events. I didn't mix up anything. Number one, this guy was fully responsible for bringing in. Can you deny the fact that he openly admitted in his phone call to Ed Brown that he brought in Dutch, who was the FBI informant that brought down Emmeline Brown? Can you deny that he got funding by Larry Pratt, who paid for his attorney? Can you deny that? Can you deny any of it? Oh, is that right, Donna? Well, okay. I'm not going to waste my time with it, you know. Anyway, moving on there. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, don't forget, come up tomorrow. Michael Lazarian joins us on the program. And we're going to be talking about his new film, The Architects of Control. So it should be very interesting there, as it usually is. Let's get into The World Order, a study in the hegemony of parasitism by Eustace Mullins. And this is a very important book. We're on chapter one here, and chapter one is entitled The Rothschilds. Let's continue now on with this. The Rothschilds had decided upon the formula of a managed conflict for the First World War because of the difficulty that had encountered in defeating the Bears from 1899 to 1901. After illegally annexing the Transvaal in 1881, the British had been turned back with a resounding defeat by Majuba by Paul Kruger in 1889 because of the discovery of a vast wealth in gold and diamonds in South Africa. The Rothschilds came back to the Luther Nation with 400,000 British soldiers pitted against 30,000 irregulars. I don't know what I'm talking about, huh? No, you don't know what you're talking about. Screw you. And if you're trying to deny what I'm telling you, you're probably part of the bad guys, and I don't have time for you. Goodbye. I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, did you not hear the tape recording where he admitted he brought in Dutch to Edna Lane Brown's house? He admitted that on tape. How can you deny that? I mean, even Ed himself said, why did you bring that guy into my house? You see? So, yeah, I'm not even going to engage in it. That's all there is to it. You know, I mean, you know, we expected you just take trash talk from people who don't even give a rat's ass about this network or the shows or anything else. They just want to come in here and dissuade the mindset back over to their old school line of thinking, because that's all they've got left, you see. They know this is the next level. They know this is where people come for the truth. So they send these people in the chat room to come in and, oh, did you hear what so-and-so said? And to post these links back over to somewhere else. Well, guess what? Go somewhere else with it. Goodbye. Let's move on. British soldiers pitted about 30,000 irregulars, that is, farmers with rifles, from whom the Bears could put into the field. The Bear War was started by the Rothschilds' agent, Lord Alfred Milner, against the wishes of the majority of the British people. And, of course, Alfred Milner is where the Milner's Roundtable of the Fabian Socialists started from. And, of course, that right there tells you that the Rothschilds are behind wholeheartedly the world socialist system. And, I found in my research that they are involved in the creation of the Council for National Policy itself to bring in socialism on the left and on the right. And, of course, no surprise there, you'd have Rothschild sitting at the table of the Council for National Policy. So there you go. The Bear War was started by the Rothschild agent Lord Alfred Milner against the wishes of the majority of the British people. His plans were aided by another Rothschild agent, Cecil Rhodes. Well, of course, Cecil Rhodes, the Rhodes Roundtables, and by no means infrequent denouement among other Rothschild agents in the base of the entire foundation of the empire today. The British fought a no-prisoner-scorched earth war, destroying farms and mercilessly shooting down bears who tried to surrender. Within this war, the institution of concentration camps was brought to the world as the British rounded up and imprisoned in insanity, fever-ridden camps anyone who thought to be sympathetic to the Bears, including many men, women, and children who died by the thousands. The genocidal policy would next be used by the Rothschild Finance Bolsheviks in Russia, who adopted the Bear War concept to murder 66 million Russians between 1917 and 1967. There was never any popular reaction to either of these atrocities because of the control of the media, which makes discussions of these calamities a taboo subject. Well, that's right. Of course, you've got the Rothschilds owning Reuters and all these other news agencies. The career of Lord Alfred Milner, 1854 to 1925, began when he was a protege for Sir Evelyn Baring, the first Earl of Cromar, partner of Baring Brothers, bankers who had been appointed Director General of Accounts in Egypt. Baring was then the financial advisor of the Khedive of Egypt since 1864. Milner had been active in the Colonel Society, founded in London in that year. In 1868, it was renamed the Royal Colonial Institute and was heavily financed by Barclays Bank and by the Baring, Sassoons, and Jardine Matheson, all of whom were active in founding the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and who were heavily interested in the Asiatic drug traffic. The staff economist of the Royal Colonial Society was Alfred Marshall, founder of the monetarist theory, which Milton Friedman now peddles under the aegis of the Hoover Institution and other supposed right-wing think tanks. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, thank you, Mr. Mullins, for now just confirming something else and showing that the Hoover Institution is connected to the Milner Roundtable and Cecil Rhodes and that socialist Rothschild in, because, of course, you know, as I said, and as I found in my research, which is going to be in my film, these groups are wholeheartedly what started the Council for National Policy. Well, lo and behold, guess who's a member of the Hoover Institution? Any guesses? Any guesses? None other than your wonderful Patriot Movement, God, Paul Craig Roberts, the father of Reaganomics, who you hear on Patriot radio shows all the time. Member of the Hoover Institution. Ha ha! You people are going down. You're going freaking down! Ah, oh, I love it. God, I love it. I mean, we've got the proof. I mean, it's just, I love it. I just thrill at the fact that I know we're going to bring these criminals down. I love it. Man, and I love Eustace Mullins. God bless Eustace Mullins. Tell you what, the staff economist of the Royal Colonial Society was Alfred Marshall, founder of the monetarist theory, which Milton Friedman now peddles under the aegis of the Hoover Institute and other supposedly right-wing think tanks. Marshall, through the Oxford Group, became the patron of Wesley Clair Mitchell, who then brought Burns and Friedman. In 1884, Milner augmented the work of the Royal Colonial Society with an inner group, the Imperial Federation League. Both groups now function as the Royal Empire Society. Vladimir Halperin and Lord Milner in the Empire writes, "It was as though Milner and some of his friends of the Roundtable group came into being. The Roundtable, it should be said, is an authority to this day on all Commonwealth interests." He states that Milner raised a considerable sum of work for the Roundtable, including £30,000 from Lord Astor, £10,000 from Lord Rothschild, and £10,000 from the Duke of Bedford. Also £10,000 from Lord Ivar. Milner launched a magazine called the Empire Review, and later called the Roundtable Quarterly. Exactly, the Milner's Roundtable, the Balfour Declaration. Halperin also knows other contribution of Milner. He played an important part in the drafting of the famous Balfour Declaration in December of 1917. Exactly. Is the fact that with Balfour, he was its co-author. As far back as 1915, Milner had realized the need for a Jewish national home and never ceased to be warmly in favor of its creation. Milner, like Lloyd George, Army, and many others, saw that the Jewish national home could also contribute to the security of the empire in the Near East. The Milner Roundtable later became the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations combined, which exercised unopposed control for the world order over foreign and monetary policy in both the United States and Great Britain. Milner trained a group of ambitious young men who became known as the Kindergarten. Exactly, Milner's Kindergarten. These were the people that later formed the World Anti-Communist League, the Western Gold Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, the John Birch Society, the Council for National Policy, the Pioneer Fund. These are the British race scientists, ladies and gentlemen, that operate out of the National Society for Ethnology and Eugenics based in Edinburgh, Scotland, which is exactly where the Clive and Set operated from. Boy, oh boy, how come it's taken Josh Reeves at 32 years old to bring you this information? And this stuff's been sitting here on the shelf for 20, 30 plus years, rotting away. Meanwhile, we've been listening to, truth guerrillas. Ah! and stuff. Huh? Lord Lofton, the youngest member of the kindergarten, and he served privately to Lloyd George from 1916 to 1920, was given credit as largely responsible for the German of the Treaty of Versailles. His Who's Who goes on to say that he played an important part in dealing with India, all denominations in the U.S. He was ambassador to the United States in 1935 to 1940 and was a close friend of Waldorf and Lady Astor. George Geesom Goshen, a liberal who was hailed as the greatest chancellor of the Exchequer, head of the Cunliffe Goshen Banking House of Lord Cunliffe, governor of the Bank of England. Goshen was also chancellor of Oxford and the University of Edinburgh. And one also was based in Edinburgh near the university. Again, the National Society for Ethnology and Eugenics, the British Race Science, those that created the Pioneer Fund, with Roger Pearson, the ones that sought to prove that blacks are genetically inferior to whites. And these are the people involved in the Council for National Policy. So, of course, they were funded and started by the Rothschilds, who funded Adolf Hitler, and we talked about early in this book, with their funding of course, the Harriman brothers and Brown brothers Harriman and the Rothschilds funneling money through them and setting them up as their predominant banking family in the United States so it didn't have a Rothschild name attached to it, because then the Americans at that time wouldn't have gotten on board with something with the name Rothschild because they wouldn't have put their money in a Jewish bank. Oh, man. Oh, you people just thought we were never going to figure this out, didn't you? You sure did. But we sure have. And it's game over for you. It really is. It's just straight up game over for these clowns. Oh, good stuff. Oh, man. Little S. Amory, who had two sons, Leopold, who was executed as a traitor in 1945, and Julian, who then married Prime Minister Harold Macmillan's daughter, and served as left-wing correspondent for the Spanish Front, 1938-39, Churchill's personal representative, to the Jean K. Shea, 1945 Roundtable Conference on Malta. So we'll talk more about this reading out of The World Order, a study in the hegemony of parasitism by Eustace Mullins, right here on Global Reality. Stay with us.
Howdy.
His number one word of use is change.
You are now the home of Cutting Edge Radio.
Of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today. This hour, reading out of The World Order, a study in hegemony of parasitism by Eustace Mullins. And great book, great read. And this first chapter here of the Rothschilds really breaks down the all-reaching tentacles of their control. And very interesting stuff. I want to continue reading out of this. The senior Leopold Amory is described as a passionate advocate of British imperialism. Oh, is that okay? I understand now. Just one second here, folks. Bear with me. Let's see where I leave off. But he was also a star on the staff of the Times and wrote a 7-volume history of the South African War for the Times, serving the cabinet from 1916 to 1922. He was also a trustee of the Rhodes Trust. The Milner-Rothschild relationship was described in Terrence O'Brien's biography, Milner, on page 27. Milner went to Paris on some business with Alphonse de Rothschild. Business calls in the city included a formal visit to Rothschild's weekend with Lord Rothschild at Tring, and a visit with Edward Cecil, Lord Salisbury at Hatfield. While spending a weekend with Lord Rothschild at Tring, a press lord gave him a sleepless night, no further explanation given. Talks with Lord Rothschild, Milner attended a Zionist dinner given by Lord Rothschild, sitting next to Lawrence of Arabia. Milner lost no time in recreating his link with the city. He went first to Rio Tinto to re-elect him to its board, and before long, Rothschild asked him to be its chairman. Rio Tinto was one of the key firms in the Rothschild empire. Herbert Hoover also appointed director of Rio Tinto. He would soon be asked to the Belgian Relief Commission, which prolonged World War I from 1916 to 1918. The Milner role in starting the South African War is described in British Supremacy in South Africa, Chapter 1, is headed by Sir Alfred Milner's War, and explained as follows. On March 19th, Chamberlain telegraphed to him, "The principal object of His Majesty's government in South Africa is peace. Nothing but a most flagrant offense would justify the use of force." Milner had become to believe that the war with Transvaal was both inevitable and desirable. Milner had last convinced Chamberlain that the British supremacy in South Africa would be jeopardized unless the power of the Transvaal was broken. There is the evidence that the Rothschild's roundtable minion, Milner, cold-bloodedly participated in the Boer War for his master's gain. John Hayes Hammond, chief mining engineer for the House of Rothschild, also was sent to South Africa to precipitate the war. He formed the Unitlanders Reform Committee with Lionel Phillips, head of gold and diamond mining firm, Eckstein, the corner house, George Farrar of the East Rand Property Mines, and Colonel Frank Rhodes, brother of Cecil Rhodes. This is the heart of the Fabian Socialist movement, folks. This is how they assumed control right here. This is what we're talking about. This is whole cloth how the Fabian Socialists assumed control on both the left and the right. The committee was financed by Abe Bailey, Solly Joel, Barney Bonanno, and the Epsteins, all of whom were big winners in the partition of the gold and diamond properties after the war. During this activity, Hammond was arrested by Paul Kruger, sentenced to death for promoting revolution, and was allowed to leave only after paying a $100,000 fine. He was then hired by the Guggenheims at a $500,000 a year salary, and in 1921 became chief lobbyist for the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Like other enterprises with which the Rothschilds have been connected, the Bank of England has also been a center for international intrigue and espionage since its founding in 1694. Although the Rothschilds did not become associated with the bank until 1812, when Nathan Mayer Rothschild increased his fortune 6,500 times by taking advantage of false rumors that somehow swept the London Stock Exchange, reporting that England had lost at Waterloo. The Bank of England originated in revolution when William III, Prince of Orange, drove King James II from his throne. Since the Bank of England charter was granted by William in 1694, there's never been another revolt against the crown. The royal family has been secure because the source of money crucial to revolution has remained under control. King Charles II had managed to retain a shaky position because of support from the Duke of Buckingham and others whose first names formed the word cabal, introducing a new term for entry. Well, that's interesting that all the people involved, their first names formed the word cabal. King Charles, Duke of Buckingham, that's interesting. The successor of James II tried to placate the powerful lords of England, but even his longtime supporters, sending a change of power, began secret negotiations with the Prince of Orange. Wilhelm I, Prince of Orange, had been married several times to Anne of Saxony. Today, every ruling house of Europe, as well as those out of power, is a direct descendant of King William, including Queen Juliana of the Netherlands, Margrethe, Queen of Denmark, Olaf V of Norway, Gustav of Sweden, Constantine of Greece, Prince Rainier of Monaco, the Grand Duke of Luxembourg, whose son is married to the daughter of C. Douglas Dillon. Lord Shrewsbury had been given places by both Charles II and James II, nevertheless playing a leading role in the revolution. He took £1,200 to Holland to support William in 1688 and returned with him and was made Secretary of State. Sidney Godelson, one of James II's last adherents, joined with the Duke of Sunderland and the Duchess of Portsmouth in correspondence with William prior to the invasion of England, was appointed head of the Treasury by William himself. Henry Compton, Earl of Northampton and Bishop of London, had been removed by James II. He signed the invitation to William to come to England, and he was reinstated in his see in 1688. His son Francis became Lord Privy Seal. John Churchill, 1st Duke of Marlborough, had entered into negotiations with the Prince of Orange in October 1687. Marlborough ancestor Winston Churchill, whose former daughter-in-law, Pam Harriman, is the leading power of the Democratic Party, is described in the Captain General by Ivor Brown, the Commissioner of Public Accounts, found that Duke Marlborough had accepted gifts amounting to some £60,000. Isn't that interesting? Churchill and Harriman in bed together, huh? Big shocker there, isn't it? Marlborough claimed it had been spent for intelligence, but witness testified he could not have spent more than £5,000 for this purpose in all of his campaigns. Donald Chandler's biography of Marlborough points out that the bread contractors, such as Solomon and Moses Medina, were for the most part Spanish or Dutch Jews of varying reliability and venality. We'll talk more on the other side. Eustace Mullins, The World Order, right here on the Global Reality, folks. Stay with us. Back here with you on the Global Reality on this Tuesday edition of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you so much for being with us today for the broadcast. And we got a lot more to get into and talk about. Reading out of the World Order today by Eustace Mullins. Boy, I'll tell you what, the information in this, this chapter on the Rothschilds alone is unbelievable stuff. And if you've never read, well, I still haven't, you know, I've still never got my hands on a copy of The Curse of Canaan by Eustace Mullins. That's one of my dream books. I want a first edition copy of that at some point in my life. I want a copy of it in general, hard copy, but that's a great, that's another one I should read on air at some point. The Curse of Canaan by Eustace Mullins. I mean, you want to get into how the banking elites are tied to the ancient societies and the secret societies in the original, civilizations. Boy, I tell you what, that's a great one. Sorry about that. I had to turn my sound down there for a second. Well, we talked about that yesterday. He went missing back in 2006, and then he appeared again, and he was in a nursing home. Michael Bell had actually talked to Eustace Mullins several times. They had him on the Intel Strike Report. Then Michael Bell had got Eustace on with me, and we had him on this show back in February. And we were going to try to have him on again, and Michael Bell gave me his phone number, and we had tried to contact him. We haven't been able to locate where he is. So maybe at some point we'll be able to try to locate him again. And as soon as we can locate Mr. Mullins, again, we'll get him up on the program again with us. But, I don't know. It's just, I wouldn't necessarily say he's missing. It's just we're just not able to get in contact with him. So we'll continue to try. I wanted to get him on again and do another show. He's just great to have on because he's like an old classic car. You know, you start him up and he's kind of slow getting going, but boy, once you get him cooking, man, I mean, it's just smooth sailing. But we'll try to contact him the nursing home where he was staying. The number was disconnected, so and we just sort of hit a dead end. We'll just have to see what happens there. But I mean, he's an American treasure and somebody that I want to get back on the show again, if we can. Let's continue now with The World Order by Eustace Mullins. The most important act of William's reign was his granting the charter of the Bank of England in 1694. Although most of his biographers omit this salient fact, the concept of a central bank, which would have been the power of note issue, but had the power of issuing money, had already taken hold in Europe. The Bank of Amsterdam was started in 1609. Its members aided Wilhelm in his conquest of England. These banks were chartered by financiers whose ancestors had been bankers in Venice and Genoa. As the tide of the world power shifted northward in Europe, so did the financiers. The Warburgs of Hamburg had begun as the Abraham DeBanco family, the largest bankers in Venice. An interesting technique is revealed by the charter of the Bank of England. It was slipped through as part of the tonnage bill, which was later to become a recognized parliamentary technique. The charter provides that rates and duties among tonnage of ships are made security to such persons as shall voluntarily advance the sum of £1,500,000 for carrying on the war against France. Other European banks, such as the banks of Genoa, Venice, and Amsterdam, were primarily banks of deposit, but the Bank of England began the practice of pointing its own credit into money at the beginning of the monetarist system. The Bank of England soon created a new class of money interest in the city, as opposed to the power of the old barons whose fortunes derived from their landholdings. And right there, see, that's exactly how it went from fortunes being derived from holding land into fortunes being derived from the credit system of loaning monies to countries, in which the Rothschilds pioneered in the whole control of the world through fiat money. I mean, that's really the genesis point for it right there, ladies and gentlemen. Of the 500 original stockholders, 450 lived in London. This was the dawn of the preeminence of the city, now the world's leading financial center. For this reason, the Rothschilds identified their key American banks with the code word city. Early descriptions of the shareholders of Bank of England identified themselves as the society of about 1,300 persons. They included the King and Queen of England, who received shares of the value of £10,000 each. Marlborough invested £10,000. He also invested large sums for his commissions in the East India Company in 1697. We know what the East India Company did, controlling the opium trade, and later became governor of the Hudson Bay Company, which paid a 75% dividend. Lord Shrewsbury, who invested £10,000, Gandolphin, who invested £7,000, he predicted that the Bank of England would not only finance trade, but would carry the burden of her wars, which is proven true in the next 300 years. Virginia Kells writes in The Great Marlborough, England emerged from the war as a dominant force because of the Bank of England's credit system enabled her to bear the burden of war without undue strain. So right there, going back to the 1700s, Britain was able to further the war machine and able to keep their economies afloat by the credit system that the Rothschilds and the Bank of England set up. I mean, you know, again, we're talking about something, right here what we're talking about, we're talking about something that happened in the 1600s. And we're finding in the 1600s stuff that is holding true and, you know, happening right now in 2009. More on the other side, this is the Global Reality. Stay with us.
One of the world's largest authorized TeamSpeak host providers on the net.
Explore any topic you wish. Your own world of information is only a page away.
Back here with you on the Global Reality on this Tuesday edition of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you for being with us today, and we're going to continue in this segment reading out of The World Order by Eustace Mullins, and then we'll get into some news and other topics as well in the fourth hour of the show today. Boy, this is very interesting stuff because, I mean, as I mentioned before the break, we're going back, you know, several centuries in time here, and this information that we're going back is just, you know, very prevalent in what we're seeing today. So this idea of being able to use the credit system of fiat money to fund wars without causing countries to go bankrupt in the process. I mean, it's genius. And, you know, of course we know, and everybody knows, and of course the Rothschilds now last year admitted to it, we know that they fund and control both sides of every war and half of Napoleonic era. Yes, we know that, and yes, we can throw that tidbit and that factoid out and regurgitate that like it's nothing. But do we really understand what that means and how they were the architects of being able to make sure that predominant war powers and, you know, the big superpower countries are able to fund their wars of genocide while at the same time making sure that their country doesn't go bankrupt in the process of funding these wars? And the Rothschilds were the architects of that. And, of course, Eustace Mullins was, as he usually was, the first one to bring that information out. The Bank of England has played a prominent role in American history. Without it, the United States would not exist. The American colonists considered themselves loyal Englishmen to a man, but when they began to enjoy unequaled prosperity by printing and circulating their own colonial script, the stockholders of the Bank of England went to George III and informed them that their monopoly of interest-bearing notes in the colonies was at stake. He banned the script with the result that there was an immediate depression in the commercial life of the Americas. This was the cause of the rebellion. As Benjamin pointed out, a little tax on tea amounting to about $1 per year per American family could have been born. But the colonists could not survive the banning of their own money. The Bank of England and the Rothschilds continued to play a dominant role in the commercial life of the United States, causing panics and depressions for the Rothschilds whenever their officials were instructed to do so. When the second Bank of the United States expired in 1836, President Jackson refused to renew it, creating great prosperity in the United States when the government funds were deposited in other banks. The Rothschilds punished the upstarts by causing the Panic of 1837. As Henry Clew's writes, 28 years on Wall Street, the Panic of 1837 was aggravated by the Bank of England when it, in one day, threw out all of the paper connected with the United States. So, I mean, do you have any more doubts, ladies and gentlemen, of who controls this country? And how it's, since the beginning, it's been, if the Rothschilds weren't allowed to control our money, control our monetary system, they were going to tank this country? I mean, it's blackmail on a grand scale, and that's exactly what ended up happening here. I mean, Andrew Jackson was getting ready, he threw the damn bastards out. And when he threw them out and started setting up the Bank of the United States, started setting up our own monetary system, boy, oh boy, they started taking this country into oblivion. So right there, folks, you know, everybody, well, we got to do away with the Federal Reserve. Look, unless you can fix this problem of the Rothschilds controlling the money, controlling the countries, controlling the credit and the loans of the countries, and controlling the war machines, you're never going to stop any of this. You think, why do you think these people live on their own sovereign nation? Because if they know when the people ever wake up, there's going to be riots in the streets, and there's going to be people coming to their house ready to burn their damn house down and pull them out by their necks. But fortunately for them, they live on their own little sovereign nation, so if you go and try to, you know, invade their sovereign nation, it's an act of war, and they can call out any army in the world on you because they fund all the armies of the world. Ha, ha, ha. That's what I'm telling you here, folks. This is the kind of power we're up against, and that's what we have to start thinking outside of the box in the way how we're going to take on these people. By refusing to credit American notes and stocks, the Bank of England created a financial panic among the holders of that paper. The panic enabled Rothschild's agents, Peabody and Belmont, to reap a fortune in buying up depreciated stocks during the panic. The Bank of England has played a prominent role in wars, revolutions, and espionage, as well as business panics. When Napoleon escaped from Elba in 1815, the London gold market jumped overnight from 41 to 5 pounds 7. The leading buyer was Nathan Mayer Rothschild, who was under orders from the British Treasury to dispatch gold to the Duke of Wellington, grooving to stop Napoleon. After Waterloo, the price of gold dropped. During the 20th century, the most important name of the Bank of England was Lord Montagu Norman. His grandfather, George Ward Norman, had been governor of the Bank of England from 1821 to 1872, longer than any other man. His grandfather, Lord Colette, was the governor of the Bank of England from 1887 to 1889, a managing partner of Brown Shipley Company in London for 25 years. In 1894, Montague Norman was sent to New York to work in the offices of Brown Brothers. He was befriended by the W.A. Delano family and lived with the Marco family, partners of Brown Brothers. In 1907, Norman was elected to the court of the Bank of England. In 1912, he had a severe nervous breakdown and was treated by Young in Switzerland. He became deputy governor of the Bank of England in 1916 and later served until 1944 as governor. The Wall Street Journal wrote of him in 1927 that Mr. N. Collette Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, is now head and shoulders above all other British bankers. No other British banker has ever been as independent and supreme in the world of British finance as Mr. Norman is today. He has just been elected governor for the 8th year in succession. Before the war, no governor was allowed to hold office for more than 2 years, but Mr. Norman has broken all precedents. He runs his bank and his treasury as well. He appears to have no associations except his employees, and he gives no interviews. He leaves the British financial world wholly in the thick as to his plans and ideas. The idea that one individual ran the Bank of England to suit himself with no influence is too ridiculous to be considered. What about the Rothschilds? What about the other shareholders? Harold Quigley in Tragedy and Hope notes that Mr. M. Norman said, "I hold the hegemony of the currency. He is the currency dictator of Europe." Final Fraser of J. Henry Schroeder Wagg notes in his autobiography, All to the Good, that he was in charge of Lord Norman's personal investments. He also notes of the firm of Herbert Wagg, former jewelers from Halberstadt, and now a London banking house. The firm was official brokers of the stock exchange to the great and all-powerful House of Rothschild. Both Wagg and Schroeder had been in business in London for 159 years, and when they merged in 1960, another writer notes that Lord Norman frequently consulted with J.P. Morgan before making his Bank of England decisions. Gordon Richardson, chairman of the J. Henry Schroeder from 1962 to 72, then became governor of the Bank of England from 1972 to 1983, when he was succeeded by Robert Lee Pemberton, chairman of the National Westminster Bank, also director of Equitable. He married into the Cecil Bury family. The present directors of the Bank of England are G.W. McMahon, deputy governor since 1954, economic analyst treasury 1953 to 57, and advisor of the British Embassy of Washington 57 to 60, Sir Adrian Cadbury, chairman of Cadbury Schweppes, director of IBM UK, and Leopold de Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild & Sons, George V. Blunden, executive director of the Bank of England, served with the IMF from 55 to 58. I mean, IMF, the IBM, Cadbury, Swiss. This is New World Order. This is Bilderberg Group. This is all of the top banking, finance, heads of state, military industrial complex, multinational corporations all colluding together. And this is really the beginning of it. We're going to stop right there. Come back. Fourth hour around the corner. Lots more to talk about. This is the Global Reality. Stay with us.
ConquerTheWorld.com. Again, that website is www.ccwpromotions.com.
You are now the home of cutting edge.
lot more to talk about and get into today on the show. Check us out at justin.tv/globalreality, and we show films, documentaries. We show all kinds of stuff over there. Occasionally, I pop on and do a live video feed. Well, I haven't done one in a while, but generally because most of the time, man, once you do 4 hours of radio, you don't want to talk anymore. I don't even want to talk to the dog, much less talk to about information anymore. He's doing 4 hours. I'm not that much of a talker. Yeah, motor mouth, sell it to the wall. No, literally, I'm really not that much of a talker in real life. I don't really talk all that much when I'm not on the radio. I really don't. Just forced to do it because, of course, you know, do a radio show, you have to talk. That's what it is. Well, you tune in, right? Didn't tune in for dead air, but nonetheless. People are still searching for the Fulford anus kissing video clip. You know, if you see new GT guy in the chat room, if you see him, hit him up with it. He knows exactly how to put his hand right on it. He's the one that showed it to me yesterday. So there you go. I don't know, man. Does anus kissing discredit someone's information? Well, it certainly should, in my opinion. I don't know. Let's get back into the news now. German mogul kills himself over a financial meltdown. German billionaire Adolf Merkel has committed suicide after his business empire, which included the interest raising from pharmaceuticals to cement, ran into trouble in the global financial crisis, the family said on Tuesday. The 74-year-old's body was found Monday night near railway tracks at Blauenburg in southwestern Germany. Prosecutors in nearby Ulm said in a statement they described the death as a railway accident and said there was no evidence that anyone else was to blame. His family, which reported Merkel missing after he failed to return home Monday, issued a brief statement saying he took his own life. So he took his own life by laying on top of railroad tracks? Does that sound odd to anybody else but me? I mean, if you were going to kill yourself, why would you lay on railroad tracks to do it? I don't know. That seems strange. It seems very strange. The Illuminati believe that they can suck the life spirit out of a person through intercourse with what they call the Eye of Horus, the anus. Yeah, that's what they think. They think the Eye of Horus is the, yeah, that's true. I've read that. But, yeah, so Adolf Merkel allegedly killed himself, although, you know, how would you, I don't know. That's just not the preferable method of death, I don't think. I mean, you know. This guy's probably getting ready to blow the whistle or something. Yeah, I mean, if you're drunk, yeah, sure. But, I don't know. It just seems strange. But, I guess maybe there's nothing to it. I don't know. It just seems weird. Here's a very interesting story. This is one I've been waiting to get into all day. And I'm going to use the final 6 minutes of the broadcast of this segment. We've got one more segment after this. And, this is very interesting. Boy, this one, you guys are going to get a big kick out of this one. Terrorists could use insect-based biological weapons. Jeffrey Lockwood, professor of entomology at Wyoming University, and author of The Six-Legged Soldiers Using Insects as Weapons of War, said such Rift Valley fever or other diseases could be transported into a country by a terrorist with a suitcase. He told BBC's Radio 4 Today program, I think a small terrorist cell could very easily develop an insect-based weapon. He said it would probably be much easier than developing a nuclear or chemical weapon, arguing that the raw material is in the backyard. He continued that it would be very easy and relatively, what kind of freaking bug is that this guy's holding in that picture? That thing was, I've seen one of those before. Those things are nasty. I saw one of those one time and I got the hell away from it. I don't know what that is. He continued it would be relatively easy in a simple process. A few $100 in a plane ticket, you could have a pretty good stab at it. Why in the hell do these people know? Why are they allowed to go on radio programs and talk about how, what ways that Al-Qaeda and terrorists could make weapons of mass destruction using insects? Why are these people allowed? I mean, even, let's just say you could do this, right? Why are they allowed to go on radio shows and talk about it? I mean, what would happen if we started having on guests on this show talking about how you could make weapons of mass destruction using bugs? I mean, they'd shut us down. Unflippin' believable stuff. But yet these people are just allowed to go on, you know, BBC and give the quote-unquote terrorists the keys to the kingdom on how to do this stuff. You know, if it's a possibility, that's why this stuff never floats with me. If this stuff is a possibility, then why in the hell would you go on the radio and tell the bad guys what to do and how to do it? I mean, it's such a fraud. It's conditioning, folks. It's social conditioning. It's get your mind acclimated to the fact when they roll out some false flag, they can say, well, what we have determined, going back to our the story that was from the London Telegraph back in January of 2009, I'll refer you back to that story. We had the story where it said that it may be possible to launch biological attacks using insects. So we believe that this is probably what Al-Qaeda did. They have the technology to do it, and that's probably what they did. Meanwhile, it's them dropping sarin gas and everything else, you see. This is what they do. It's a backstory. It's them building a backstory so they can later go back and have something, you know, have a patsy and have a fall guy for it. Government, he advised, need to have robust pest management infrastructure that's able to absorb and respond to an introduction of infected insects. Oh, really? Kind of like the brown apple moth, huh? I mean, does anybody else see, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Anybody? Anybody? What's the first thing coming to your mind? Warlick? Come on. What am I thinking about here? Read my mind for me. What am I adding 2 + 2 to equal here? The fact that, the Al-Qaeda may be using these bugs now, so we have to have more of this spraying going on to combat these horrible Al-Qaeda insects. You know, same thing as the brown apple moth. Oh, so we have to spray biologicals on San Francisco to fight off the brown apple moth. Oh, here we go. Anybody else but me see them cooking this up? Rift Valley fever is an East African disease which can cause severe disease in both animals and humans, leading to high health rates of disease and death, according to the World Health Organization. However, WHO says the vast majority of human infections result from direct or indirect contact with blood of organs or infected animals. Right. So even the World Health Organization says, well, the vast majority of human infections result from direct or indirect contact with blood or organs or infected animals. They don't come from contact with insects, no. But, very interesting stuff there, and you know, here we go. Fayette schools? Yeah, Fayette schools and teachers, please donate your raises. School board members say if the county's teachers would return 2.5% raises, it could help the 24,000 student system stay afloat. So now the government training camps are now crumbling, and now the government training camp teachers are being asked to give back part of their raises. Return your raises, and we'll keep the system afloat. You can keep your job so long as you give back part of your raise. Yeah, that's real good stuff, isn't it? I tell you what, these people just don't quit. All right, final segment around the corner. We'll hammer a lot of hard news here in the final segment around D right here on the other side of the break. Stay with us.
Howdy.
You're listening to the Broadcasting Network on the Revolution.
Of this Tuesday edition of the Global Reality right here on Oracle Broadcasting. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thank you for being with us today for the show. Final segment is blessed for you here on this Tuesday edition. Bush Library donors to be kept secret. Well, imagine that. Dallas, Texas donors to the new presidential library probably will remain a mystery, according to the nonprofit foundation overseeing its fundraising. It's our decision not to disclose who the donors are, said Mark Langdale, president of the George W. Bush Presidential Library Foundation, citing some donors' preference to remain anonymous. The foundation will oversee construction of the library, museum, and public policy institute at the Southern Mississippi University campus in Dallas, had raised less than $3 million when the latest tax reports were filed in August. That's far short of the $300 million goal. The foundation officials said the fundraising will pick up significantly after Bush leaves office January 20th. So he's, you know, shadowy group of investors, yet again, getting behind the Bush Library. There you go. Very interesting there. No doubt. All right, what else we got? We covered that one today. Data breaches up almost 50% of corporate records of 35.7 million people. This is from the Washington Post. Businesses, governments, and educational institutions reported nearly 50% more data breaches last year than in 2007, exposing the personal records of at least 35.7 million Americans, according to a nonprofit group that works to prevent identity fraud. Identity Theft Resource Center at San Diego is set to announce today that some 656 breaches were reported in 2008, up from 446 in the previous year. Nearly 37% of the breaches occur at businesses, while schools accounted for roughly 20% of the reported incidents. And this is all done by design as well. Of course they want there to be leaks. Of course they want there to be. Because then they say, oh, well, that's why we need to have more security. That's why we need more federal funding for this. And, of course, at the same time, that just gives them an excuse to be able to look at your personal information. Foundation of New World Order is uncertainty from the Wall Street Journal. More New World Order articles. We have two today. Every day now is an article with New World Order in it. At the start of this year, investors find themselves in a new world where vast walls of territory are marked unknown. There's always uncertainty in investing. This year, however, the availability of capital, one of the most important variables in the functioning of an economy, can always be taken for granted. New World Order this, New World Order that. Oh, this was, I meant to play this clip, and maybe we'll play this another day. Museum plan for Saddam's palace. Saddam Hussein's former compound in Basra Palace was the scene for fierce battles between British forces and the Iraq insurgents in 2007. Now experts hope to transform the palace into a museum for the region's ancient treasures. So they're going to turn Saddam's old palace into a museum now. Probably filled with all the fake antiquities that are modeled after the ones that Special Forces stole during the invasion in 2003. Woman accused of cannibalism deeply ashamed. A woman accused of killing, dismembering, and cannibalizing her ex-boyfriend says she's ashamed of doing a horrible thing. Aw, she's ashamed of it. Wow. That sounds like she's remorseful. Jan Lynn Woodry was found not guilty by reason of insanity after the 93 slaying of a 51-year-old Peter Green of Alamosis, who was committed to the Colorado Mental Health Institute in Pueblo, but has gradually won more freedom since then. So we got more cannibals running the streets. That's always good. Take that, Andromeda. Our Milky Way galaxy is actually far larger than our celestial neighbor. We didn't have time to get into that today. Very interesting article there. I'm just ripping links in the chat room left and right here. Biden on the economy says we're at war. Vice President-elect Joe Biden, proud to be a Zionist, likened the country's economic crisis to the attacks of 9/11 on Monday at a private meeting on Capitol Hill. We're at war, Biden told congressional leaders of both parties during their sit-down with Barack Obama in the Capitol. According to two sources familiar with the exchange, it's not the first time the Vice President-elect has used stark language to underscore the perilous state of the economy. In an interview last month with ABC's This Week, Biden said the stimulus package was needed to help the economy from absolutely tanking. And again, don't just associate anything with 9/11. They just don't care. They'll associate it with anything. Yeah, exactly. Luckily, the NWO doesn't exist. Yeah, that's a good one. FBI Hiraway, we covered that one. It's about coming to the end of my stack here. We almost covered all. I can't believe we actually had a day where we covered all our news. Well, here's one I didn't get to cover yesterday. Bioethics professor seeks to drug college students with Ritalin before exam. John Harris, professor of bioethics and director of the Institute for Science, Ethics, and Innovation at the University of Manchester, is at it again pushing for drug use by college students who want to enhance their brain power before exams. What drugs should they be taking? Amphetamine, he says. Speed. Of course, he doesn't mean they should be able to take any amphetamines they want. They should only be able to buy big pharma's amphetamines that just happen to make a ton of money for the drug company. It's okay to teach college students to abuse mind-altering drugs if there's an exam score on the line after all. So, goodness. Yeah, eat you some Ritalin, man. It'll help you ace the test. Here, yeah, I'm not getting kickbacks from Big Pharma for this. No! Nothing to see here. Move along. No. Surely not. But it just doesn't matter. I just can't believe it. How the city hurts your brain. The city has always been an engine of intellectual life. From the 18th century colony house of London, where citizens gathered to discuss chemistry and radical politics, to the left bank bars of modern Paris, where Pablo Picasso held forth on modern art. Without the metropolis, we might not have had great art of Shakespeare or James Joyce, or even Einstein was inspired by commuter trains. And yet, city life isn't easy. Now scientists have begun to examine how the city affects the brain and the results are chastity. Just being in an urban environment, they have found, impairs our basic mental processes. After spending a few minutes on any crowded street, the brain is less able to hold things in memory and suffers from reduced self-control. While it's long to recognize city life is exhausting, this new research suggests that cities actually dull our thinking and sometimes dramatically so. And this is why they want us herded all into compact cities. This is why they want us in these control grids, in these compact cities, out of rural areas. This is why they want to rewild America. This is part of what the UN, biodiversity, all this stuff is about. Because they want us in these compact cities where our brains can't critically think. Of course. What a better way to do. Bush would like to see Jeb as president. Former President George Herbert Walker Bush said on Sunday he'd like to see his second son Jeb become president of the United States someday. Well, I'm sure he would. And I'm sure you probably will. Goodness. Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, over and over and over again, and it's the same old thing. Same old thing over and over again. Well, we're coming to the end of the show. Don't forget, please let everybody know that tomorrow we will have Michael Tesarian on the broadcast with us tomorrow. Should be a great show. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. We'll see you guys back here tomorrow with Michael Tesarian. You guys take care. Have a great rest of the night. Have a great one.
America Lynch, a pillar of truth, has risen.